Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome. I'm Brian McGee, and I'm your chairman for this occasion, which is a presentation of a lecture by the Karl Popper Memorial Fund. Quite a number of the people who pass through LSE become truly world figures, and this afternoon we're going to hear a lecture on one of them by another of them. When Karl Popper died only 4 years ago at the age of 92, still active, still publishing, still having new ideas, he had long become truly a philosopher of world standing. Although he always regarded himself primarily as a philosopher of science, I think one can safely say that his most widely known book is The Open Society and Its Enemies, which is, of course, a work of political philosophy. Our lecturer this evening is going to talk about that. And he is someone who has performed the almost unique feat of having two simultaneous top-level careers in two different countries, Germany and Britain. He's held a whole series of top-level jobs in each of them. In Germany, among many other things, he's been a Member of Parliament. And in Britain, among many other things, he's been the head of LSE and is now, of course, a Member of our Parliament in the Upper House as Lord Dahrendorf. Ralph Dahrendorf is going to talk about, and the question is, the open society, a useful project or an empty concept? Lord Dahrendorf.
Thank you very much, Brian. Some concepts have an annoying quality. They sound and potentially are attractive, but they are also so loose, so baggy, that many are tempted to stuff their own preferences into them until their original definition gets confused and eventually lost. Our public discourse at this time provides illustrations. The recent Queen's speech, for example, managed to mention modernization 11 times in the space of 10 minutes. Legal aid will be modernized, which means making it more cost-effective. The welfare state will be modernized by inviting greater individual contributions. Local government will be modernized by directly elected mayors. The law on immigration and asylum will be modernized, and heaven and the Home Secretary knows what that means. The third way, dare I say so, in these halls and in the presence of one of its inventors, is about to have a similar fate. Is it more than a name for everything New Labour does? And what exactly is New Labour anyway? The open society has come to be a concept of this kind. It is this sense of annoyance which made me formulate the advertised title of the lecture. Is the open society a useful project, or is it an empty concept which anyone can fill at his or her pleasure? I had just read a very long German dissertation entitled The Order of Freedom, K.R. Popper's Model of the Open Society. Having reduced his computer text to the smallest legible size, the author still managed to submit over 600 pages. In Oxford, one don is said to have torn such a mammoth work apart and evaluated only the statutory 100,000 words. but the German author was cautious enough to present his work in two volumes. In his erudite and thoughtful analysis, he attributes all sorts of things to the open society. Abstract things, like theoretical institutionalism and negative utilitarianism. Practical principles, like those of removing governments, of limiting market processes, and highly specific demands, like basic income guarantees and an ecological tax. Shortly afterwards, I heard George Soros, in the context of his Open Society Institute. It is incidentally by no means the only organization of this name. Organizations which carry often a Gesellschaft or Società Aperta in their names are widespread from Klagenfurt to Bari. Soros gave us a preview of the book on the crisis of global capitalism, which he will introduce in the context of the school next week, and which actually claims that capitalism, far from epitomizing the economic facet of the open society, is endangering the project unless it is domesticated. In the process, Soros wants to redefine the open society as an ideal which is equally threatened by communism and by market fundamentalism. What is it that tempts people to use the term open society for such diverse purposes? Why, above all, does it seem to lend itself as a bottle for all kinds of wines, sweet and dry, raffinated and adulterated, and above all, endlessly diluted? In the good Protestant spirit of the scholar which I once was, I went back to the sources, that is to Karl Popper. First, I looked up the monstrous volumes edited by Paul Arthur Schilp and sometimes misleadingly referred to as Popper's autobiography. I soon discovered that these volumes contain relatively little about the open society. The book, The Open Society and Its Enemies, is described by Popper as his war effort, written in the dismal New Zealand exile, where people did not want to know his attacks on canonized figures like Plato or even Hegel, for that matter. Few of those invited to contribute critical comments to the autobiography dealt with this work of Popper's. In fact, only two really did. One was Edward Lord Boyle, the former Minister of Education, who gave Popper occasion to thank him for the most generous personal appreciation. The other was Professor Peter Winch, whose piece Popper found puzzling, and the polemicist in him was in his element. I quote, "Professor Winch's central criticism reads like a sustained argument, but I found it difficult to unravel what the point was and what Professor Winch was objecting to." So what did the Open Society mean to its author? The answer is not very much. Although the manuscript of the Open Society had the unusual effect of leading Fritz von Hayek, Harold Lasky, and Lionel Robbins to agree, in this case, to agree on offering Popper in 1945 the readership in Logic and Scientific Methods at LSE, which he duly accepted. However, while acknowledging the marvelous institution Popper, in his autobiography, also reminds us that, I quote, "the social sciences never had for me the same attraction as the theoretical natural sciences." I can confirm that this was the view of the great man from personal experience. When I had sent him a book of mine, he remarked at our next encounter, "I like what you write, Ralph. If I was writing political philosophy, I would argue along much the same lines. But alas, I have so many more important things to do." And yet, the concept and the book, The Open Society, may well be Popper's most lasting contribution. Our chairman tonight, Brian McGee, does not quite say this in his brilliant little tract on Popper. He believes, and he must be right, that Popper's work is all of one piece, though he does devote 2 out of 7 chapters to the Open Society. He also concludes that the Open Society supports the vision of the kind of social democracy in which he, Brian McGee, believes, which leads us back to the ambiguities of the concept. Popper managed to admire Bruno Kreisky and Margaret Thatcher, Helmut Schmidt and Helmut Kohl at the same time, and they admired him. "Aren't you embarrassed about support from such diverse quarters?" I once asked him when he had shown me telegrams from all these and others which he had received on his birthday. "Why," he replied, "after all, everyone knows what I think." Do we really know? So after biography, I went back to substance, to the work itself, and decided not to spend more time on the original title of this lecture, "Is the Open Society an Empty Shell or a Precious Pearl?" but to try and define the concept and then look at 3 problems to which it gives rise. I shall call them the Gellner problem, the Kolakowski problem, and the Dahrendorf problem. Open societies are societies which allow trial and error. This is the simplest definition of the concept. I prefer it to Soros's definition in terms of the more passive recognition of our fallibility. Either way, the Open Society is in fact the application of Popper's philosophy of knowledge to social, economic, and political affairs. We cannot know, we can only guess. Our guesses may be wrong. In fact, proving guesses wrong is what the advancement of knowledge is about. It matters, therefore, that falsification remains possible, that it is not prevented by dogma or even by the vested interests of the scientific community. We cannot be sure what the good society is like. We can only advance projects to this end. Such projects may turn out to be unacceptable or inappropriate. In fact, debating their pros and cons is what life in the open society means. It matters, therefore, above all, that change, the removal of dominant projects and those who espouse them, remains possible, that it is not prevented by tyranny or cartels of interest. The analogy has its pitfalls. Popper was surely right when he pointed to profound differences between the natural and the social sciences. Time, history rather, signifies the key difference. If Einstein proves Newton wrong, Newton was always wrong. If a neo-social democratic project replaces a neoliberal one, Clinton after Reagan and Bush, Blair after Thatcher and Major, this may mean that a project which was right at its time has come to be regarded as wrong. Perhaps it even means that all projects will in due course be wrong. History knows no truth. The utopia of the good society is itself incompatible with the open society. When I lectured at this place on the good society 6 years ago, that was my main point. Though I added one thought to which I shall return as the Kolakowski problem. Society not only has history, but it is also heterogeneous. Keeping doors open for trial and error in the political sphere leads to democracy in the narrow sense in which Popper defined the notion. It must remain possible to remove governments without force, no less, but not necessarily more. Applied to economic processes, the notion that comes to mind above all is that of the market. It alone leaves open the door to changing tastes and preferences, as well as to new forces of production. Schumpeter's world of creative destruction by entrepreneurs is in some ways the economic version of the progress of falsification. In society, in the more diffuse sense, it is harder to find the equivalent. Probably the notion of pluralism is relevant here. One can also think of civil society, that is, of a plurality of associations which are neither explicitly nor implicitly coordinated. They form a kaleidoscope of ever-changing constellations. The notions of democracy, the market economy, and civil society must not mislead anyone into believing that there is only one institutional form to give them reality. On the contrary, there are many. All that remains essential for open societies is that there are rules of engagement which allow the continuation of the process of trial and error. Whether these involve a presidential or a parliamentary or a referendum democracy, or indeed under other cultural conditions, institutions which we would be reluctant to call democratic, whether the market operates in the form of Chicago capitalism, or family capitalism Italian style, or German corporatist business practices, and again, there are many other versions, whether civil society is based on private initiatives, or local communities, or even religious organizations, what matters is that change without violence remains possible. The whole point of the open society is that there is not just one way, nor are there two or even three, but 101. That is an indefinite, unknown and unknowable, but large number. This is why 1945 and 1989 are such critical and exhilarating dates in the dismal history of the 20th century. They mark the defeat of the enemies of the open society, and thus not the victory of another system, but the opening up of wide and varied horizons of opportunity. Diversity and variety are now the name of the game. There are many ways to try, and it is wrong to recommend, let alone to impose, just one version of democracy or of market economy to those liberated for the new openness. There are, on the other hand, new dangers also, and they have to do with ambiguities and problems arising from the concept of the open society. The subject of Popper's war effort was, of course, Nazi Germany, and thus the hope for what came to be 1945. His book was completed in 1943. He was tracking those enemies of the open society who in some ways would have been used and could have been used to provide justification for the totalitarian regimes of the right. Plato's omniscient philosopher kings were for him as threatening as Hegel's and Marx's historical inevitabilities. Both ruled out trial, let alone error, and instead conjured up the too many tempting image of an Arcadia without conflict and change, which in fact would be a world of tyranny and terror. The powerful statements at the end of the first volume of Popper's Open Society are much quoted. They still reverberate and are therefore worth quoting yet again. Arresting political change, and I quote, is not the remedy. It cannot bring happiness. We can never return to the alleged innocence and beauty of the closed society. Our dream of heaven cannot be realized on earth. Once we begin to rely upon our reason and to use our powers of criticism, once we feel the call of personal responsibilities and with it the responsibility of helping to advance knowledge, we cannot return to a state of implicit submission to tribal magic. For those who have eaten from the tree of knowledge, paradise is lost. The more we try to return to the heroic age of tribalism, the more surely do we arrive at the Inquisition, at the secret police, and at a romanticized gangsterism. Beginning with the suppression of reason and truth, we must end with the most brutal and violent destruction of all that is human. There is no return to a harmonious state of nature. If we turn back, we must go the whole way. We must return to the beasts. The alternative is clear. If we wish to remain human, then there's only one way, the way into the open society. These are evocative words. For those who remember the time at which they were written, they bring back even now that tribal language of the Nazis, blood and soil romanticism, the curious titles of youth leaders as Hordenführer, indeed Stammführer, tribe leaders, the constant invocation of Gemeinschaft against Gesellschaft. Coupled, however, with total mobilization, as in the Albert Speer designs of mass party rallies first, and in total war, as well as the industrialized mass murder of Jews soon after. And yet, there is an ambiguity here, which points to a problem in defining the enemies of the open society, and even to a flaw in Popper's analysis. It also points, incidentally, to an unresolved issue in the theoretical debate of totalitarianism. The ambiguity was brought home to me by Ernest Gellner. He, of course, came to be deeply engaged in the consequences of that other relaunch of the open society, the revolution of 1989. One of his interests was the emergence of vicious nationalisms in the former Yugoslavia and elsewhere. At the time, it was almost commonplace to observe that after communism, ancient tribal loyalties reared their head again. History returned with a vengeance. Gellner was furious with such facile theories. He insisted that the new nationalism had nothing to do with ancient bonds and ties. It was, in fact, a specifically modern phenomenon. It was the mobilization of people whose loyalties had been broken, mobilization by ruthless leaders who knew how to make political capital out of people's insecurities. Bosnia, for him, was anything but the return of history. It was the future, or at any rate, one possible face, the ugly face of the future. Early analyses of German National Socialism led to a similar dispute. There were those who saw the Nazis as representatives of an archaic, pre-modern Germany, and those who sought explanations in terms of the anomie of modern social life. I have, on reflection, come to the conclusion that Ernest Gellner was right, and that along with Popper, I had confounded two sets of enemies of the open society, which are not only distinct, but which pose quite different challenges. One is the tribe, the traditional closed society. The other is modern tyranny, the totalitarian state. The latter may use the symbolism of the former, but in the end, the Stammführer is not a tribal chief, but a cog in the wheel of a centrally organized party state whose power is, if anything, based on the destruction of ancient bonds and ties rather than their revival. The process, and here I quote Gellner, the process by which an open, mobile, growth-oriented, modular social order emerged from the feudal or baroque absolutist, status-oriented, anti-productive system was long, complicated, and turbulent. Notionally, it meant a basic transformation of European values as well as of social organization. Thus, his definition in his important book on civil society of what is properly called the process of modernization. It was painful everywhere, the more so in societies which embarked on it late. It meant for some a paradise lost, though for many it was liberty gained. Calling it irreversible risks falling into the historicist trap, especially at a time at which various kinds of fundamentalism or integrism tend to gain support. Yet it is hard to see how the road from status to contract, from escutcheon to achievement, from mechanical to organic solidarity, indeed from Gemeinschaft to Gesellschaft, can become a two-way street. This particular enemy of the open society, the closed traditional society, is gone. It may provide a useful vocabulary for modern rulers, but their real intentions and methods are very different. In a sense, Popper fell for the vocabulary when he described the enemies of the open society in terms of returning to tribal magic, to the beasts. He got closer to the truth with the phrase romanticized gangsterism. The new enemies of the open society are gangsters using the romantic sentiments of many to detract from their evil deeds. Thus, the Open Society is a modern project. It presupposes that people have left their self-imposed infancy in Kant's definition of the Enlightenment. The tribal Arcadia invoked by Popper describes not so much its enemies as its distant forebears, or perhaps some caricature of their ways. The real enemies of the Open Society are the other moderns, Hitler and Stalin too, and those all too many murderous dictators in our own time, of whom one must hope that they will be brought to justice. In assessing their role, we should beware of falling for their rhetoric. They are not the true heirs of tradition, but its ultimate foes and destroyers. Dare I add, if Popper had been more of a social scientist, as Gellner most certainly was, he might have seen the difference between what Max Weber called traditional and rational power, the benevolent liberty of the past and the ambivalent freedom of the modern world. Other tasks of a social science which is not afraid of big issues come into view here. One is the question to which I have alluded, whether modernization is a one-way street or not, and what would have to happen for the flow of change to be reversed. Another more immediate, though already much studied question is that of the conditions under which modern societies turn one way or the other towards openness or closure, and by implication, what protection there is against the threats of a new closure. Both issues have to do with what Leszek Kolakowski, in an essay on self-endangering open societies, calls threats from within. In a sense, he argues, Popper's enemies are just that, forces, in a sense, outside the open society which threaten its survival. But there are also properties of open societies themselves which can lead to the paralysis, even the destruction, of their openness. Some of Kolakowski's internal threats hinge on the strictness or looseness of the definition of open societies and also on the relevance of the neoconservative project of recent times. For instance, Kolakowski argues, by reference to Hobhouse's social democratic liberalism more than to Popper's liberal social democracy, that the open society requires limitations on the forces of the market in order to enable every citizen to participate. The result is the welfare state, which in turn may lead to an extension of state power, which paves the way for totalitarianism. Or again, Kolakowski points to the risk that the principle of equality of opportunity, which he regards as intrinsic to open societies, turns by default into new kinds of privilege and thus closure. This moves him towards reflections on the limits of liberty, that is, on the rules by which open societies can protect their underlying principle of trial and error. Underneath such questions, however, there lies the deeper one of how open societies can be sustainable. This depends, as Kolakowski says, not just on the persistence of existing institutions, but on a widespread readiness to defend them and a belief in their worth. Here we get close to the Habermas question of reasonable identity, of giving reasons why polities, economies, societies should be organized in this way and in no other. Moreover, it could well be argued that such reasons need to be not just reasons of the mind, but reasons of the heart. How is a commitment to open society engendered, which protects them against enemies within and without? As this is a subject on which I have written and spoken on many occasions since my little book on life chances, a brief comment must suffice here. Yes, the open society is a code project. It has engendered a profound commitment by Karl Popper and by a number of others, in which I include myself. But we are a curiously abstract band of men, yes, mostly men. We can live by the quiet passion of reason. Democracy and the market economy, too, are code projects. So is civil society, at least as a general concept, though a vibrant civil society gives room for many emotions. As such, however, the open society, like democracy and the market economy, does not provide the ligatures, the bonds, which give people a sense of belonging. Until his recent book, I should have included George Soros in the abstract band of men. But now the crisis of capitalism has him so worried that it led him, in his own words, to reconsider the concept of open society. It, quote again, offers too little rather than too much, and notably suffers from a deficiency in social values. From being a principle, the open society has to become an ideal which embodies certain moral values, values, incidentally, which are incompatible with market fundamentalism, and which replaces the enlightened individual by what Soros calls the encumbered individual, who has a sense of belonging to a community. It is possible to agree with the thrust of Soros' argument without agreeing with his conclusion, the redefinition of open societies. For one thing, there's much to be said for Isaiah Berlin's principle that our conceptual language must above all be clear. Open societies which allow trial and error are not, by the same token, societies which solve all our problems. Actually, Popper himself had a momentary lapse in this regard when, presumably out of niceness to famous men, he spoke in a footnote of the affinity of his concept to Graham Wallace's Great Society and even to Walter Lippmann's Good Society. The question is therefore not whether the crisis of capitalism is incompatible with the open society, but whether it can be resolved, whether market fundamentalism can be replaced by Soros capitalism within the framework of the open society. After all, belonging to a community is not incompatible with the open society, even if its structures do not by themselves promote it. For those undeterred by the quiet passion of reason and even the coldness of open societies, there must thus be ways of coping with the Kolakowski problem other than the reconsideration of the concept. Leszek Kolakowski has found his own admirably Anglo-Polish way. I am very fond of Poland and intrigued by its curiously non-explosive mixture of socialism, nationalism, and Catholicism in the old days. But in the face of the Kolakowski problem, as I have called it, that of threats to the open society from within, and notably the threat of anomie, I preferred to turn to the Anglo-Czech answer given by Ernest Gellner in his beautiful King's College sermon on the uniqueness of truth. The future, Gellner says, lies not with some secular counter-revelation, but rather in that ambiguous, unstable, uneasy relationship between faith, indifference, and seriousness, which I, Gellner, have tried to describe. Of course, Gellner worried about ways to implement such pragmatic modes of belief in countries for which brutal discontinuity was the condition of the new openness. Given that there is no clear faith, he said, to replace the old, how does one engender a compromise ambiguity if one has to do it at once without waiting for slow growth? Gellner gives the answer himself. How indeed? Nothing is more difficult to bring about than reasonable compromise. Western Europe, he says, took centuries to progress from doctrinal absolutism to ambiguous and tolerant compromise, and the process was largely spontaneous. The self-destroyed ideocracy of Eastern Europe is trying to achieve the same overnight and by decree from above. Can it be done? Perhaps yes, perhaps no. It is a big task in any case. As Ernest Gellner says at the end of his sermon, blessed are they who only face our problem. Yet there's one issue left, which I have not seen discussed anywhere in the context of Popper's philosophy. Popper certainly has not seen it as a problem. If trial and error defines the open society as well as the advancement of knowledge, what if people stop trying? What if no one endeavors to discover anything new? Karl Popper would probably have regarded the question as absurd. He was always bubbling with ideas and could not imagine a world in which people, scientists or citizens, simply sit back and let things be. But his unquestioned assumption that everyone else was like him, or at any rate that humans are by nature indomitably active, so that the question of indolence could not arise, may after all be wrong. The question is not one of essentials of human existence, even of human nature, but rather, are there circumstances in which people find it convenient to stop trying out new ideas and instead accept what exists and live with it? And what of the open society if that happens? The question has several interesting aspects. Perhaps not everybody needs to be directly involved in the process of trial and error. Certainly, Popper never assumed that every human being was involved in the process of scientific discovery. In that sense, there was something elitist in his approach. Put more kindly, trial and error are in some sense representative activities undertaken by some on behalf of all. But what if not even some continue the process? What if there are no discovery-hungry scientists left? What if Schumpeter's entrepreneurs cease to emerge and the kind of economic rigor mortis sets in which Mansa Olson saw on the horizon? What if Michael Young's school of social entrepreneurs fails and the active civil society sinks into indolence? I have long thought that there was something discouraging in Popper's strictness. If only the falsification of established theories means progress, then 9/10 of all scientific activity are useless. If only the removal of government proves democracy, then we may as well forget about regular political activity. The conclusion, however, is risky. In fact, what one might call normal science and normal politics are the seedbed, the necessary condition of those dramatic moments which mark major steps forward. Active citizenship does make sense, if only to encourage virtues which in the limiting case prove the central point of the open society. Like the dramatic moments of lost theories and lost elections, perhaps even of the crisis of global capitalism, normal scientific, political, economic activity in the open society has to be public. Trial and error are public events, visible, open to critical appraisal, an invitation to all to participate. The existence of a public sphere of critical discourse is therefore an indispensable element of the open society. Democracy cannot work without democrats, but democrats cannot do their thing without breathing the air of freedom of information, freedom of the press, freedom of association. Perhaps this air not only encourages but even produces those activists who keep the process of trial and error going. But the air of freedom is not a condition which necessarily lasts. I have referred to Olson's Rise and Decline of Nations, in which he argued that long periods of stability can engender a kind of economic stagnation that borders on entropy. At one point, he hints, with a reference to Jefferson, that only a war can shake nations out of such complacency. In that, he was fortunately wrong. Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan did the trick even as Olson was putting the last touches to his book. But to turn to politics, there is a kind of authoritarianism which discourages trial and error by a general air of coziness. Why bother becomes the prevailing attitude. Things are not bad, and as long as they continue that way, one may as well leave public things to those in authority and withdraw to one's private affairs. As long as they continue that way. Once they get worse, however, while the old nomenclatura is still there, it is too late to wake up to the need to try a new project. Authoritarianism can lull people into a false sense of security until the public inactivity which results leads to the destruction of the open society. This, rather than some capitalist crisis, is, in my view, the deepest problem of some Southeast Asian countries. This is also where the post-communist countries of East and East Central Europe find it hardest to move towards new horizons. Awakening activity in the public sphere is therefore one of the first tasks of reform in the interest of creating open society. If the open society is not also an active society, it will soon cease to be open. But openness by itself does not create the activity which is needed. What does? I have long liked Immanuel Kant's strictures against the Arcadian longings of many and his insistence that our unsociable sociability, our penchant for power and possessions and the resulting social conflicts, were the foundation of our freedom. Popper has certainly set an example, not just by his ideas, but by his often fierce polemics and by his indomitable curiosity. the quip that his personal ways disproved his theories, the open society by one of its enemies, the book has been called, the quip is mistaken. Critical discourse and political conflict are the lifeblood of a world in which people never cease trying and erring and trying again.
Ralph Dahrendorf has very kindly offered to answer questions, and so now I invite them from members of the audience. Who would like to set the ball rolling? I can't believe that it, yes.
Open society. How do you keep it open? You recently had the example of Dulwich School, where they invited the neo-fascists to come and talk. The deputy head said it's up to the boys to make a decision. In 1933, Germany made that decision. It was a wrong one for the rest of the world. Do we still allow these people to broadcast their ideas so that other people can make the same mistakes?
I have not listed every legitimate and important issue that has to be raised about the threats to open societies and the way in which they can defend themselves. But the simple answer to your question is open society does not mean that there are no limits to people's demands. I'm not commenting on the particular case to people's demands or desires, even if these demands or desires would destroy the very framework within which the open society works. That's an ancient, or by now a relatively old and exceedingly difficult set of questions, and one where there is probably no perfect answer, but where one has to be aware of risks and dangers as they arise.
What is the borderline between utopian and open society? And can you say open society is a more developed, more sophisticated, more special kind of an utopian society?
Well, I wish George Soros was here, in which case I would ask him that question in his revised concept of the open society, because he runs a risk there in this revised concept of saying that it's no longer a principle within which we operate, but it is an ideal, as he puts it. I have not said that. To me, utopia is the notion of a perfect society. The notion of a perfect society which you strive to achieve, which doesn't exist anywhere at the moment, may perhaps never exist wholly, but which guides your action. The open society is a set of principles within which all kinds of ideas of the perfect society can compete, and in which it remains possible for different ideas of the desirable society to compete. Utopia, therefore, that is the notion of a perfect society, has been, through this century, an instrument of the destruction of the conditions of open societies, the destruction of liberty. Utopia has been used to dismantle what I call the rules of engagement of open societies, and I would regard the difference, therefore, as quite fundamental. But it's really important to be precise in one's conceptual language. And I'm talking about open society as I defined it.
There's a question up there, right at the back of the
the microphone to give. The microphone doesn't seem to be working. Speak as loudly as you can, and I'll repeat the question.
You didn't mention the media, and the media has the media regulation has been one of the main instruments of the war that has been following the night. Can you make a comment on the law of the media and open society?
The question is that Ralph Dahrendorf didn't mention the media, and can he now comment on the role of the media in the open society?
Well, I did mention freedom of expression at a rather critical point in my argument, and I think it hardly needs saying that trial and error as a public process require the possibility to express audibly, or legibly, but audibly is the right word really, a variety of projects, of views of where we should be going. So that principle is very much part and parcel of the open society. The real question is not so much the extreme case and obvious case of Yugoslavia or parts of ex-Yugoslavia in the critical period. The real question is our own of the relationship between plurality, competition within the media world, and the openness of our debate. The real question is, what if the media become the instrument for the creation of that authoritarian indolence, which, as you noticed, I'm quite concerned about? That's the more subtle, the more complicated, and certainly in West European societies, the more topical issue. The other is part of the freedom of expression point.
There's another another question in the gallery. Yes.
To add to the conclusion between the first volume of The Open Society and Its Enemy, is a beginner's piece of writing. Do you think that the case that Popper makes for the betrayal by Plato of the historic Socrates is a historical understanding question that has never in fact subsequently been registered in the historical understanding of Western philosophy that we have in terms of its importance and its implication for the understanding of everything that follows from that?
Well, in a sense, as a Popper lecturer, I am a fraud because I'm not a professor of philosophy and unfortunately never have been, and therefore I wouldn't dare commenting on Western philosophy and the whole process. Brian McGee could do that very easily. The reason why I quoted these impressive sentences is to make a critical point which struck me fairly recently and which is more a social than a philosophical point. It is that these evocative statements nevertheless confound two quite different things. That is modernization and the illiberty or liberty of modern societies, to put it in different language. That was my purpose, but I leave it to our chairman to answer the philosophical question.
And I will leave it to the next questioner to ask his question. This here first, then the gentleman there.
I was just wondering, you mentioned, or you addressed the question, what if people stopped trying? What if people stopped wanting to change the society? Can it not be assumed that following from, say, behavioral psychology and pedagogics, the study of children, can it not be assumed that we have some sort of inert intrinsic curiosity and intrinsic striving for change and for discovering new things. Can that not be assumed looking at what we are when we are young, and that these sort of behavior modes stay with us even when we grow older?
Maybe yes, maybe no. I wouldn't wish to rely on the assumption alone. And what I'm concerned about are notions like inner emigration, which at certain times are happily used by people who abstain from engaging in any public process of initiating ideas, expressing curiosity, expressing critical views, and are satisfied with doing this privately and at home. I do believe that one of the characteristics of the later nomenclatura socialism was that it survived for quite a long time as an authoritarian and not a totalitarian regime. A totalitarian regime is one which is based on the mobilization of people, on the permanent mobilization of people. An authoritarian regime is one which sustains itself by people's indolence and disinterest, by people just not bothering to criticize, take part in affairs, and notably not in offending those in power. And I believe we have seen extended periods in which this was how almost everybody behaved, and in which very, very few expressed that allegedly innate temperament which you describe. So even if one accepts the assumption to which you refer, there are obviously conditions under which people are prepared to suppress the urge, however strong it is. Incidentally, this is where, for instance, are such important, historically important people, even if it was a relatively small group in some countries at certain times, because they have made it clear under unlikely circumstances that there is the desire to try new ideas, try new notions of social, political, and economic order. So the assumption alone is not enough for me for the analysis which I intended.
Gentleman beside you, Michael.
Actually, it's a couple of questions. Do you find it sort of a contradiction or ironic that the closed societies of Hitlerism and Stalinism have been overcome in that sense, but institutions within the open society, I'm taking like the House of Lords, of which you are a member, have been around for hundreds of years, and will tomorrow, will you be going there in the name of democracy and an open society for the abolition of the hereditary peerage and renouncing your lordship? That's the first question. The second question is, do you actually say that the open society is synonymous with free market capitalism? And if it is, will that last forever? Is that the end of history?
If you had asked me to list some of the most splendid institutions of known open societies, I'm not sure the House of Lords would have appeared on that particular list. On the other hand, I think it can hardly be argued that the House of Lords makes Britain a closed society. Incidentally, I understand your allusions about the open lists for European elections and the House of Lords as the defender of democracy. Well, there you are. Open societies can be defended from the strangest corners. But it is entirely within my concept of the open society if an elected parliamentary majority not only takes away the voting rights of hereditary peers, but wanders at least as much about the precise reason why I am there, and those of us who are appointed technically by prime ministers and are not particularly, in that sense, legitimate. I think your second question is a very important one, and I don't want to be misunderstood on this. First of all, I think there are probably forms of market economies which are not in the textbook sense capitalist. And I have placed great emphasis on market, which again means on a form of economic organization which allows changes not only of tastes and preferences, but also of the conditions of economic activity, I called it forces of production, to work their way through without fundamental upheaval. And I think that some form of market-like organization is part and parcel of an open society. But there are many ways of doing it. This is a thesis which I cannot repeat too often and which is often unrecognized. There is not just one way of doing it. And even if you introduce the private ownership element and other features of capitalist economies, there are many forms of capitalism in the real world. And we are making a mistake if we take what I would call the Chicago model as the only one. It's just not true. There are many ways in which countries organize their market economies with private property. I referred to some of them. And this variety alone makes it meaningless to speak of the end of history or of the beginning of history when these modern economies were created. This variety alone makes it clear that there's an enormous range of possibilities of economic structure, organization, and activity within the concept of the open society.
Can I ask a question, Ralph? Do you regard the open society as compatible with the absence of a market economy? In other words, do you regard the open society as compatible with socialism under its classical definition of public ownership and control of the means of production, distribution, and exchange?
Well, the simple answer to that is no, it's not compatible. The more complex answer is that even public ownership can take a variety of forms. And I could certainly imagine, I mean, we're not now talking about political prospects of programs for today, but I can certainly imagine a market situation in which cooperatives play the role which privately owned enterprises play in others. In other words, it is the private ownership is not the only way in which markets can operate. It is the most likely, perhaps, and certainly the most likely today. But if you take classical state socialism, I would regard it as incompatible, yes.
The gentleman there, and then after him, someone in the background.
Yes. Yes, I just wanted to address one area that's not been talked about too much. This goes on top of the theme on media. Technology and alternative means of communication, because you mentioned concern about public discourse and political criticism. And I think technology certainly played a role in 1989 to enable that to occur and eventually the downfall of the Soviet regimes. I guess my question is, with the given presence of the internet and all the other new means of communications, do you leave yourself as an optimist or a pessimist based on your concern about public discourse, political criticism, and the fact that we've got so many technologies and alternative ways of communicating?
Well, so far as technology is concerned, I actually agree with you that it's, or with the implication of your question, that it encourages those who want to try out new things. and it is very hard, as you know, but possible, to prevent people from making use of these new technologies. There are pretty extreme cases, like not just North Korea, but Burma. And there are also interesting cases of sanctioning the consumption of technology in the authoritarian states of Southeast Asia. So there is no guarantee built into technology, but it helps. So far as the main part of your question is concerned, I'm often asked whether I'm an optimist or pessimist with regard to the things I want to see. I tell you what I am. In terms of analysis, I prefer the downside. I prefer to emphasize how difficult things are. My conclusion from this analysis, however, is that something needs to be done. So I have practiced for quite a long time a combination of negative analysis and then active deeds to improve things. And that sort of bypasses the optimism, pessimism dichotomy.
The gentleman in the back row, and then somebody in the back row over there.
You mentioned something about authoritarianism providing a false sense of security, and that why should people change when everything is going so well? And you said this is the deepest problem in some countries in Southeast Asia. But most of the countries in Southeast Asia are multicultural societies where the slightest new ideas or proposals might just disturb the balance or equilibrium which exists between the races. Right now, authoritarianism seems to be working. Small changes seem to be working, and it's gradual. So what is your alternative? How do you advance the idea of the open society without disturbing the balance?
I confess I'm quite skeptical about your notion of the balance and disturbing the balance. I'm not talking about you personally, but it's a notion which can so easily be used for the purpose of cementing the interests of those who are in charge and in power. I mean, I'm, as you speak, thinking of Singapore, where you can say people are on the whole apparently quite comfortable. Economically, they're doing well. They don't have any great problems of housing or many other needs. On the other hand, in view of the ethnic minorities, the housing something or other, whatever the huge organization is called, allocates them in ways which the government thinks are best for ethnic minorities to live together. And the whole thing begins to resemble, I won't say a cemetery, but certainly a peculiar place in which there is a minimum of movement, especially movement of ideas. Now, it is, that's why I use the word cozy, it is a cozy world for many. Then suddenly people begin to wonder, incidentally, it's quite an interesting case, Singapore. People begin to wonder why, despite the wonderful salaries and even working conditions, the University of Singapore never produces anything interesting. Or people begin to wonder why the financial center of Hong Kong, if indeed it were to migrate anywhere, would certainly not go to Singapore. Be much more likely to move to Bombay than to Singapore, to give an example. Why is it that this coziness destroys creativity and in the process reveals that there is something missing, which may be something quite deep and quite important. So I worry a bit about this word balance, although I have made one other point which is relevant to your question, and that is I don't argue that there is only one institutional way to bring about change, one particular model of parliament or whatever. There are other ways, and they may be appropriate, but arresting change in this particular way is not only the creation of closed societies, but is a violation, in my view, of essential demands and desires of liberty. It's not an easy question, but my own strong view is that the great threat to the open society today is not totalitarianism in most parts of the world. It is creeping authoritarianism, and incidentally, I don't accept European countries for that at all. I think this is as true here as it is in many other parts of the world. And it's this creeping authoritarianism which I was implicitly, if not explicitly, arguing against in the last few minutes of my introduction.
A question in here, and then we'll have one from the gallery who's been waiting for a long time.
Following your refinement, perhaps, from the questioner and Brian McGee's question about the relationship of the open society to capitalism, and I know that you've given a much more sophisticated definition of that than that word implies. But what about the disease of capitalism for the open society? Although you say that the open society needs only perhaps a form of market freedom or something like that, isn't it the case that the demise or the difficulties of capitalism, even in areas of the world where perhaps the open society does not exist, is a matter of concern for those living in the open society?
Again, it is important not to burden the concept of open society with issues which can perfectly well be fought out within it. And that is actually crucial to my whole argument. And the question is, are we really talking about economic or socio-economic or political economic developments which touch the very principle of the open society, or are we talking about aberrations which can be corrected within the framework in which we are living? This, incidentally, is probably, so far as I can see, the deeper difference between my own view and that which George Soros defends in his recent book, although he is not unambiguous about it. He tries to cope with it by including certain things in the notion, new things in the notion of the open society, which help him out of the dilemma that on the whole he would like to continue to be a capitalist, but he would also like the disagreeable aspects of capitalism to be abandoned in the interest of the open society. Now, I think it's probably a little more complicated. I'm quite convinced now that, I've always been convinced it's part of the open society, that we don't get things right the first time round, that we are dealing with mistakes, with great mistakes which are being made, but that we can actually cope with these mistakes, including those of the short-term movement of capital and its ramifications for the stability of governments and indeed of whole societies, without redefining the whole open society framework in which we are living. It's an issue, and we would now have to look at the kind of political clash or kind of differences of view, which would have to be fought out in order to come to terms with some of the externalities of the financial market developments of recent years. And incidentally, once we do that, Soros's proposals are suddenly very interesting. That is, once we don't turn them into a debate about the open society, but into a debate within the open societies in which we are trying to change things, then I think they are very interesting.
So far, I've been calling questioners strictly in the order in which they've signaled to me that they want to ask their questions. I'm now in the embarrassing position of having more people in that waiting list than we have minutes left. All I can do is to continue to call people in the order in which they've waved at me, but we will have to stop, I'm afraid, in under 10 minutes from now, because our time for stopping it will be 7 o'clock. And it's now 7 minutes to. So I'll run right until the last minute, but then I apologize now to those who have signaled to me and whom I may have nodded at, but it looks as if I'm now going to get round to calling. A gentleman up there who's been waiting a long time, and then after that we come to somebody right down here in the front row.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
It doesn't work. It doesn't work.
Can still hear.
Yes, I'd like to come to the your proposition that the threat to society is our lethargy and the possibility of a reluctance to innovate and for new projects. Many questioners have alluded to this. Now, I would have thought with the imperative to technological innovation that we see all around the world today, mankind's propensity to truck, barter and exchange gives us no kind of worry that there will be continual innovation and change. But surely the real problem is the values that might underwrite new projects, and surely the insistence that the essential institutions of an open society are a flourishing democracy and a market economy, given that you're also saying there are many variants of that, the central danger surely is that the new ideas that we need to have are to be sourced from values other than market values, and the danger that we all might become consumers and not citizens.
The question of technology is actually quite interesting, whether technological innovation as such, that is, as a continuation of something invented some time ago, but increasingly refined, made increasingly sophisticated, has the kind of effect that is meant when we speak about trial and error. And I will leave the question open, but I think it is an open question. And I don't subscribe temperamentally to the view that technological inventions are the equivalent to clashes of values. You don't, actually, because you distinguish between the technological innovation and the value questions which are open. So innovation in the sense of continued process of technological development does not create a free society. We do need a lively dispute about values, and we have it. And as I understand, and this may be an overinterpretation, but as I understand what happened in this country in the last 20 years, is that we moved first into a phase in which, in a very simplified way, the conditions of economic growth with their consequences of the enrichment of the few were rapidly improved. There was a hope that this would filter down, that this would spread. But the pendulum is swinging back in the direction of recognition that there are issues, social issues, which are not only not solved by the kind of economic advancement which can be created by certain legislative and value conditions, but which are aggravated by these and which therefore need a separate approach, which therefore need, in other words, emphasis on other values. Now that's one of the conflicts which can take place within open societies, are taking place within open societies, are in a sense quite independent of the process of technological innovation, are about values, but do not affect the principle of the open society itself. They prove it in many ways. There was a trial, and after an extended period, a sufficient majority have concluded, or a sufficient number have concluded, that this trial was fine so far as it goes, but please no further, and perhaps it was in part wrong. To me, that is a desirable and normal process in open society.
My great regret, this is going to have to be the last question. Yes? Thank you.
I would actually return to Brian McGee's question, where I found a lot of people nodding and seemed interested in the question. And particular to link it back more closely to the topic of the lecture, because you defined, you were concerned with defining open society and sticking to the definition, and I took it that there were two prongs to it. One was the possibility of change of government without violence, and the other was the possibility of through the working through of changes in technology and preference without upheaval. And there are there's a gap between that and the answer to Brian's question, which was that socialism as he defined it was incompatible with open society as so defined. And I was hoping you could spend the last few minutes telling us how you personally fill in the gap in the argument there. I mean, is it a theoretical analysis of reflections on recent history, on old history, combinations, but what are the reasons that socialism, as Brian defined it, is incompatible with the open society as you defined it with those two definitions?
Well, I suppose one way of responding to this question is to say that if you combine the authority, the ability to take decisions about narrowly political issues, economic issues, and the whole of civil society in one center, and I will choose my words carefully, it is not very probable that you will be able to produce the kind of change without violence which is at the core of the trial and error principle. In other words, I'm saying a certain separation of economy, polity, and society is in itself an extremely useful instrument. That is for maintaining open societies. I think it's that notion which was somewhere underlying my remark about state socialism. And incidentally, I could make a similar remark about state societies, and there are enough state societies about, in other words, societies in which civil society is very weak because the state is all over the place. And I do think that there are serious threats to open societies there. But that's the line I would take if we had the seminar, which we should undoubtedly have, in order to pursue some of the points I was trying to make.
Well, I think I ought to show respect to our speaker, not only by my verbal language, but by my body language, by coming to the podium from which I introduced him and from which he spoke. We're enormously grateful to Ralph Dahrendorf for coming here this afternoon and giving us such a very, very meaty and interesting lecture. That it was enlivening in the most literal sense is demonstrated by the fact that after well over half an hour of question and answer,
The whole place was buzzing with people who were waving at me and wanted to answer questions, and we could quite clearly have carried on, I would guess, for at least another hour of question and answer. Thank you very much, Lord Dahrendorf.